Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
And so the problem with the stock market becoming a giant casino and everyone having access to it is that we're not all going in there with the same education, and we're not all going in there with the same knowledge of how the stock market works and all of the tricky things that are going on behind the scenes. Like, a rational person getting into the GameStop thing would know, look, this is a short squeeze. It's very exciting, but a lot of crap can happen here. Stocks get stopped, right? People stop trading. The stock market gets stopped all the time. Robinhood's IPO stock got stopped multiple times during the day. But did everyone know that could happen? Did all the people I interviewed, you know, the 22-year-olds who were buying GameStop, know that they could stop the stock from trading? I don't think they all were even aware that that could happen, right? And so we're not all going into this with the same level of knowledge. There needs to be an educational aspect to it.
Good morning, everyone, depending on where you're listening to the show. Quick reminder, Sagar and I are co-hosting Breaking Points today. We did this last Thursday. We had a really good time. And yes, everyone, I did take the very important show note. I will look at the camera this time. It's really exciting. It's really interesting to do this format with the version we do here with the podcast. You have one camera to look at. Sagar has 4 to 5. So whenever people are critical of Sagar's performance, I can personally attest to you, it is effing difficult to do this. But we're doing this later this morning. It's a real good time. Come check us out as well, too. Who are we talking with today?
We got a great guest for everybody, Ben Mezrich. You guys might know him. He wrote The Accidental Billionaires, which turned into The Social Network. He wrote a book on Bitcoin. But today, he's here to talk about The Anti-Social Network, which is about GameStop. So you might all remember GameStop. It was like the craziest period over the last year. What the hell happened with the stock and subreddits? It was David versus Goliath. It was the end of Wall Street and all of that. Or was it a long time, 10-year coming in terms of the societal bubbling up from the financial crisis? That's what me and Marshall and Ben talk about. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this episode. It's one of the most fun ones I've done in a really long time, and I think you're all going to like it.
Yeah, we obviously, last show note for the day, picked up a bunch of new listeners after I co-hosted. I'm sure a bunch of y'all here are new because of viewing it on today, Tuesday. So here's the deal. This is The Realignment. We love selling books. So we actually have a link to our bookshop in the actual show notes here. If you want to read any of Ben's books, which we cannot recommend enough, follow the link there and you'll support us, a local bookseller. If you enjoy what you've heard, we would love to get some Apple podcast reviews going. We really appreciate everything we've gotten so far and it helps people find the show. Finally, we have a great Substack, which is getting ramped up. That is sent out every Thursday. So go subscribe there as well. Lots of great stuff. I just save it. I've wanted to do this episode of Ben for a really long time. It does the great, great, great job of combining our interests in finance, in tech, in business, and politics all together. There's so much to cover here. So with a quick thank you to the Lincoln Network for supporting our work, let's dive into the episode.
Ben Mezrich, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've been big fans for a long time, Bitcoin Billionaire, Social Network. When I found out you were writing this book, I was really excited because in a way, I played a small role in it, which is that I still am unclear why this story resonated with so many people. In the middle of it, I could sense it. There was something going on. And a lot of us in the news business were worried that after the Trump era, like, the attention span wasn't going to be there. And somehow I saw it bubbling online. I grabbed onto it. I did a monologue. And to date, it still might be the most popular thing I've ever done. And the last time I checked, it had 2 million views on YouTube. And the way I know it really resonated is that people, I've been doing this for a while, and people were like, dude, I saw your monologue on GameStop. They're like, I didn't even know you had a show. I'm like, yeah, it's been, you know, it's pretty popular. It's been going on for a while. But clearly, it punctuated the zeitgeist in a way that I had not seen in a very, very, very long time. So I'm curious, just at the very top, given your book, now that we've had some time to sleep on it, why did it have such a touchstone in the culture, in that unique like January post-inaugural moment.
Yeah, I think that this was a, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of layers to it, but it was of that moment. I mean, it was all of this bubbling up anger in politics,
right,
against Wall Street, right? The pandemic, you put it all together and it was driven, I think, a lot by this anger, by this emotional moment we were all in. And suddenly it exploded. It really was this David versus Goliath thing where Wall Street was battling against regular people. And it felt like this was a moment when finally all of these people stuck at home, sitting on their couches, could do something big and maybe even win for just this brief moment that just really captured the zeitgeist. I think that there's, and I can go on and on, there's so many elements to it. GameStop itself, it's such a ridiculous company, okay? It's a ridiculous thing that this grew to such an enormous amount that we were all talking about GameStop, right? I mean, GameStop was something from our past, this video game store in a mall, right? This shouldn't even really exist anymore. And it captured the attention and became the focal point for one of the most epic battles in Wall Street history. And so, yeah, I think it was anger. I really, if I were to put one thing behind it, is this bubbling anger that's been building and building and building and just finally came to a head. Mm-hmm.
Like Sagar said, we're a huge fan of your writing. And something I really appreciated about Bitcoin Billionaires back in 2018 is you drew a really strong line between the accidental billionaires founding of Facebook and what actually happened in the crypto world. Obviously, the Winklevi twins are involved there, so there's something there. But is there a part of this story, if we can maybe posit that there's a trilogy here of the 2010s and early 2020s, is there an arc that ties these three stories together?
Absolutely. And that's the reason I called this book The Antisocial Network, not just because Reddit, which I love, by the way, but it's also home to some of the worst trolls on the internet. I think that really what we've seen is this sort of evolution from Mark Zuckerberg sitting in a dorm room and deciding, I'm going to recreate the world to fit someone like me, to create this online social world that we're all going to live in, that we're all going to be in this virtual village. And you can trace that to Bitcoin, which is the sort of libertarian dream of money that's decentralized, that doesn't have an authority, that we're all going to be a part of this community where we can just buy and sell money over the internet with no bonds, to this next level where suddenly the entire stock market is gamified and turned into something we can sit at our couch at home and play on our phones. So I do think there's this real evolution. And then in the social networks itself, you come from the happy village of Facebook, which it never really was, but that was the goal, was this happy village, to something much darker and much dirtier. And you can trace Trump and politics into that as well, but it became this much more dirty free-for-all, this Wild West that is very evident in Wall Street Bets and what went on sort of with GameStop. So absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's a trilogy. I think there's going to be 10 of these, because honestly, if you watch what's happening now with NFTs and you watch what the sort of virtual next step is, we're not done by a long shot in this story. But this is an origin story similar to the way The Social Network was an origin story, the origin of Facebook. A lot happened after that. And then you have the origin of Bitcoin and Bitcoin Billionaires. And then this is the origin of the meme stock or the gamification of Wall Street. So that's how I look at these, for sure.
It's interesting. I didn't think about it that way, but the gamification being mainstreamed actually does have pretty big sociological consequences. Like when my barber asked me about SafeMoon and I'm like, you don't, I'm like, don't do it. But I'm like, that's clearly, you know, there's something that penetrated that is making people pay attention. But let's start actually then with the actual mechanics of what happened. January 25th, that week, what was actually going on in terms of the timeline of events of how this all went down?
Sure. I think we would go back a little farther, and I would start with this dude in his basement, you know, guy from Brockton, yeah. Keith Gill, calls himself Roaring Kitty on YouTube, DFE, or whatever you want,
yeah,
you know, right. on Reddit. And this guy fell in love with a stock. You know, he was a lovable loser in a lot of ways. And I think he's done an amazing thing. But he was a guy in his basement who was playing stocks like so many people were. Everyone is stuck at home during the pandemic. And he starts talking on the internet about GameStop. He had bought a pretty for him a big position, but for a regular, you know, Wall Street guy, a nothing position, put $53,000 or so into it. And he bought GameStop, which is this kind of failing nostalgic company like Blockbuster that sold consoles and actual video games in brick and mortar stores in malls during a pandemic. So of course, hedge funds were shorting this and shorting the hell out of it. And one company in particular, Melvin Capital, a staid, you know, big dog on Wall Street, Gabe Plotkin, one of the stars on Wall Street, brilliant, brilliant guy, had shorted it. But it shorted it in a public way because he had to file with the SEC that he had shorted GameStop. And so these are two elements that come into the story later, obviously. Now, when we get to January, GameStop has slowly ridden upward for a couple of reasons by the time we reached that week in January. One of the reasons being that the short position became known on Reddit, and the Reddit mob decided that they were not happy that this hedge fund was shorting it, that there was so much short power. And they started to see inklings of the idea that if they bought into it, perhaps they could create a short squeeze. Meanwhile, Keith Gill had been pushing this stock and pushing the stock, saying, this is the stock. I know you think I'm crazy. And he'd grown a group of people who kind of agreed with him. So there were a lot of people who had bought into GameStop on that. And then a number of other things happened along the way. Some good news for GameStop being this guy, Ryan Cohen, who had created Chewy and was a brilliant, you know, billionaire, also bought into it, among others. So there were reasons why it started to go up. But the reality of what happened in those 4 days was the Reddit mob took aim at this Wall Street hedge fund to attempt to create a short squeeze. And I don't know, I know you know.
I was going to say, could you explain? No, for the audience, but this gets thrown around constantly, short squeeze, AMC, and later. But many people, you know, including myself at the time, I was like, I don't really understand what's going on here. So could you explain it in layman's terms to people?
Sure. So we all know what buying a company long is. You buy the stock in a company, you hope it goes up, you make money, right? Shorting a company is you're betting the company's going to go down. So you borrow shares of the stock, you sell it on the market at whatever the price is today. When the price goes down, you have to rebuy those shares and return them to the person you bought them from. So the problem with shorting is that there's unlimited potential for loss. Because if you buy a stock today at, you know, and you short a stock at $10 and it goes up to $1,000, you still have to return that stock. So theoretically, it's an infinite potential loss, right? It can just keep going up forever. You still have to get that stock. Now, what happens is if a lot of people are shorting one stock, there becomes this moment when if the stock starts to go up, all those people shorting have to get that stock to return it. But them diving into the market to get it also keeps the market going up and up and up. So you get in this position where you're all squeezed. It's a short squeeze. You're all diving in to try and get shares of this stock, pushing the stock higher and higher and higher. And it can potentially be very, very bad. Now, GameStop was in a position where 140% of the float was shorted, meaning more shares, almost by half of all the shares in existence, were short. More shares than existed were short. So people were shorting it, and then people were borrowing those same shares again and shorting them again. So it was so overshorted that almost anything could create this situation. If there was any good news or any kind of force of nature pushing the stock price up, suddenly everyone's diving in to try and get those shares, and it creates the ultimate short squeeze. Something like this has only happened a few times in history. I mean, to have that many shares short happened maybe 10, 15 times in the history of the stock market. And what happened was the stock went up so fast that for a moment, GameStop was the most valuable company in the world. You know, it was up there with the GEs and the Apples. Right. And remember what we're talking about. We're talking about that store you walk into and there's like Pickle Rick dolls, and like, I mean, it's not a company that ought to be worth that much. So obviously it was being, you know, not driven by the fundamentals anymore. So what happened in those 4 days is it started to go crazy. The stock started to go crazy. Melvin Capital realized what was happening, and it wasn't just GameStop, but all the thump companies that they were shorting started to get attacked in this route. AMC, there were a few others.
BlackBerry, I think.
Yeah. So basically the Reddit mob, which had grown to millions and millions of people. At one point, I think it was up to 9 million people were on Wall Street Bets, which was the board that everybody jumped onto. They had put, you know, billions of dollars into pushing this stock up. and all of these stocks up. So it became a moment where the price of GameStop went for when Keith Gill started talking about it, it was at $3-4, right? And it ran all the way up to the 20s by the, and then the 70s and 80s and 90s. And it ran all the way to in 400, closing in on $500 a share. Crazy, completely insane. And at that moment, Elon Musk tweeted, and I think this was a very big moment. And this was the moment when kind of everything comes to a head. He sees what's going on. And Elon Musk hates short selling. He's been very public about his animosity towards short sellers. Short sellers nearly destroyed Tesla. Yep. He sees it as a personal thing. He sees it as wrong, as un-American to bet on companies going down. And so he just tweeted GameStonk and linked to the Wall Street Bets board. He has 42 million followers. So this sent, you know, the stock skyrocketing pre-market, post-market pre-market. It almost hits $500 a share. And then it gets very exciting because what happens next is Robinhood. And we haven't even gotten to the Robinhood part of the story. Robinhood is part of the reason this all happened. So Robinhood is this company that, you know, set out, I think, to do a good thing, which was to democratize finance, to put into the hands of everyone the ability to trade like you're a Wall Street banker. You have on your app the ability to buy and sell options, to buy and sell shares. You don't need any certain amount of money. There's no limits and there's no fees, right? So anybody can just start trading. And it's a video game. If you've done Robinhood, which I think most of your users yep. probably do, you know, you buy your first trade and you get confetti on your phone. It's fun, right? It's like playing, mm-hmm. It's an incredibly well done app. And so Robinhood was where a lot of these retail trades were going through. And suddenly they were in a situation where there were massive amounts of buys going on Robinhood, way beyond the amount that they normally could handle. And suddenly they get this collateral call. So basically a clearinghouse call. They needed to put up an enormous amount of money to basically insure or all of these trades that were going through because of the way the system works. A brokerage has to put up a certain amount of collateral against all of the asks and bids that are going through its company. So they were in a pickle. So what did they do? They froze the ability to buy GameStop on Robinhood. And this was like a lightning strike. Basically, all of these retail people could no longer buy the stock. So in the middle of this short squeeze, the stock price is flying. Elon Musk has tweeted. Melvin Capital looks like it's going to go, you know, bankrupt. I mean, they don't say that, but they yeah. lost a lot of money. They were doing very poorly, although they had pulled out of their shares. They had closed out their short position because they had seen this craziness that was going on. But when Robinhood froze everyone from buying the stock, the short squeeze kind of dies, right? The stock starts to drop back down because you can still sell it. And all of these Wall Street banks are still able to do whatever they want. So the retail traders kind of got screwed in the situation. And that's the way it looks anyways. And the short squeeze dies. And then by the end of the week, you know, there's a lot of screaming and yelling all over the internet because it looked really bad. Because you have another element to the story too, which is that whether or not Robinhood is in the pocket of Wall Street because of the way it works. And yes. we can get into that as well. So that's kind of the drama, I think, of the story. So many layers to it. And I think if you read the book, you know, you can see it from a lot of different angles.
Yeah, before we get into those layers, I just want to ask you the narrative question here, because here's where my skepticism comes in. Sagar and I, we do like 120 of these a year. So we see a lot of people who have a lot of very convenient, very straightforward narratives about what's happening. If it's 2017, the neoliberal world order has collapsed. That's why X, Y, and Z things that I'm saying are true. If it's 2018, insert some other narrative here. So how do you know this is actually happening? And by that, I mean, I'm talking about the Wall Street post-2008 financial crisis sense of this. Because I remember we were talking to someone on a podcast and someone said, you know, this is being driven by people who woke up in 2008 and a bank had come and taken away their house and they're just fed up. I'm like, I know that narrative and that's a great narrative that makes you want to buy a book.
Right.
But is that actually happening? Because it feels to me like most of the people I was talking about this with were A, doing this to make money off of speculation, or B, doing it for the lulls. Because this is actually pretty funny. Story is pretty funny.
And I agree with you 100% the lulls part. So that ties into this, okay? Our ability to now say, screw it, I don't care. I'm going to do this. I'm going to just throw my money into this because it's a joke. that ties into the collapse, if you want to put it, of all of our confidence in the stock market, of our belief that the system is fair. We all now believe the system is rigged. We all think that the system is crap. And that goes back to 2008. That goes back to people losing their jobs while Wall Street, nobody went to jail, right? That ability to detach yourself and say, it's all a game anyways, that ties in to this. I mean, because in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, you didn't think that way about your money. And you didn't think that way about the stock market, but you do now, and it's very easy to do that. So the way I see it, and the reason I think it pulls back to this anger from 2008 all the way back to Occupy Wall Street is the anger towards Wall Street is because I just talked to everybody, you know. So to write this story, I interviewed, you know, everyone from every side of it, and as many people as I could who were involved, but also regular people on Reddit and all of the boards. And the Wall Street Bets board on the whole absolutely has this attitude of this is a big joke. We're going to put up pictures of our losses and relish and love our losses as much as we love our wins. I think that's one of the brilliance of the site and why it creates such a community. But someone who throws all his money into some crappy stock and loses it all gets tons back from the community, even more so than the guy who makes millions of dollars.
Yeah, way more.
That all goes back into the fact that the foundation isn't there anymore. You know, my parents who are older, when I'm writing this book, are like, should we be worried? Is the stock market a joke? Our money is all in these blue chips. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You should be worried because the stock market is a joke now. And I think there's this general feeling among young people, especially that this is a game. And that, you know, I'm going to try and make some money off of this, but I don't really care. I don't really care that GameStop doesn't have the fundamentals, maybe, although that might be changing now. I don't care what Dogecoin is. I don't care that this is a made up coin, right? That has a nearly infinite supply that has no use. I'm still going to make money on it, right? That thinking goes back, you know, to 2008, but it also goes back to video games and the idea that the virtual real world is just as real as the real world, and that there doesn't need to be a fundamental reality behind anything anymore. And you know, we can look for the cracks in the structures that led us to the point where we believe that, but we really are living in a simulation now. Even if there isn't really a simulation, we've all bought into the simulation theory to some extent. And I think the cracks that happened in 2008 led to us being able to do that. So yeah, I'm not saying that people were walking around with pitchforks and angry and I want to burn Melvin Capital to the ground. But yes, what was the thing that exploded all over Reddit? That Chernobyl image of them burning to the ground, right? That's the imagery that this was built on. Everyone's posts were like, I'm going to destroy this guy. I want them to die. You know, that is anger, even if you're not actually angry. And I think that also ties into the pandemic. Like, we're all so mad about this. We're not walking around saying, I hate you, coronavirus, but we are saying, I hate you, Fauci, right? There's so much anger, right, towards this, and we don't know where to aim it. And people are aiming it in all the wrong directions. I mean, people are going anti-science or people are going anti-this, when the reality is you're mad at a virus, okay? And I think this ties into GameStop, where we're mad at Wall Street because people lost jobs, people aren't making money, we're all stuck at home. You know, the economy has gone to crap, but not for Wall Street. Wall Street's doing great. And you see, you know, these guys in their suits and ties making fortunes and buying $35 million mansions in Miami while people are losing their jobs at Starbucks, right? And so I do think that drives this more than maybe people are willing to admit. I think you can say this is a big joke and I'm going to make some money on GameStop, but you're scared and you're nervous because your life is turned upside down. And you're pissed off when you see someone not having their life turned upside down, but literally making money on your failure, right? I work at GameStop and I'm going to lose my job because these people are shorting this company out of existence. That has to hurt, right? That has to, and all of us like going to GameStop, even though it's a stupid store. And someone wants to take that away from me. You know, they've taken everything else away from me, and now they're going to take GameStop away. I just feel that drives this more than you would realize. And as I interviewed people and got into it, at first, you know, yeah, it's a joke, it's funny. But when you start to talk to them, it's less and less funny. It's more and more, this is not fair. The system is not fair. And one of the characters is a big Trump supporter. One of the characters in my book is this woman, single mother of two. She's an RN, so she's actually on the front lines of the pandemic in a lot of ways. And she voted for Trump. She loves Trump. And her reasoning, and she's, by the way, a lovely woman. And when you get to know her, you actually genuinely like her. But her reasoning, it comes out of this, I have been screwed my whole life. Wall Street has screwed me. My divorces, everything has not worked out. I can barely pay for my kids' braces. And what has any president ever done for me? Nothing, right? I could vote for the right person who says all the right things, and my life doesn't change one bit. And so there's this feeling, this wanting to tear it all down, right? To do something different. And I think that drives that more than you would realize. And so, you know, people make bad decisions for good reasons, I think. And I think that plays into this whole GameStop thing, the whole idea that, you know, I'm going to do something crazy and stupid, and maybe I'll win for once. And I think that drove a lot of it too.
Interesting.
You know, you just said something very helpful that answered a question I had that I want to bring out explicitly, which is, how is this time different? So if you read any, and once again, we were like eight. So when I say read, I did not experience this personally, but during the dot-com bubble, during the 1990s, there's all these stories about there's some kid in his basement and he's buying stocks and he's not going to E-Trade or Ameritrade or any of these different platforms. What makes this post-2008, especially in 2020, what is different between these two eras? And what I want to highlight and what you really made there is it seems like that was much more optimistic than what you're describing here when you talk about cracks. So I'd just love to hear your response to that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a definite stream of nihilism going through this crowd right here and this moment in our time, in our history. I mean, first of all, social media has changed everything. And the stock market was one of the last places where they thought, or Wall Street thought, this is not going to affect us to this degree. You know, social media took on the music business. It changed writing. It changed politics, right? And it hadn't really changed Wall Street all that much yet. But now it is changing Wall Street. The whole idea of the meme stock, the whole idea that there can be a community on Reddit that has more financial power than the largest Wall Street bank. Because 10 million people with a $2,000 stimulus check is a bigger fund than the largest fund on Wall Street. And that's what starts to tear into this, is that the idea that without meaning to organize, this became organized. So the difference is, during the dot-com boom and all of those moments, you definitely had these people in their basement doing this, buying a stock, making money, but you didn't have 9 million people able to do this together. And that changes everything. And that's one big difference. And the other thing, I think, is you have the pandemic, is you have everyone stuck at home. So the same way we all watch Netflix until they've run out of shows, everybody was trading stocks and day trading, something that used to be something that a very few people did. Suddenly everyone, I mean, you know, high school kids were, you know, talking to their moms about buying some GameStop. I mean, everybody was involved in this story and able, because of Robinhood, to do it. Robinhood is another part of it, the whole gamification moment. Back then, during the dot-com boom or to 2008 or any of that time periods, it was actually kind of hard to buy and sell stocks. You had to have some level of savvy. You had to have some level of knowledge. You had to have a certain amount of money. You had to take more risk because you had to pay fees and things like that. I remember what opening account was like 10 years ago. Opening a trading account was the biggest pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. Right.
And it was hard. And you had to have, if you were young, you had to have like some other people's money backing your money because you couldn't put enough money in to do it, right? So you basically were on your parents' accounts and things like that. Today, college kids can open a Robinhood account, right? Today, right now, with a couple $1,000 in the bank. So it's become what sports betting was in a way, but legal. You know, sports betting, people were figuring out how to do it, even though it wasn't entirely legal, or you had to do it with offshore accounts. Now, with an American bank account, you can open an account on Robinhood instantly and buy and sell stocks. So this is a very new moment that I don't think Wall Street has totally taken into account yet, or totally figured out how to deal with it going forward. But this is really just the beginning of this. The idea that, you know, a place like Reddit or Facebook or Twitter can move markets is something that we're really just starting to understand. I think crypto shows that as well. I think crypto is moved entirely by social markets and social media.
I think you're completely right.
And there's obviously no fundamentals behind something like Dogecoin. Bitcoin may be a little bit more fundamentals, but the reality is the whole idea of something fundamental doesn't really exist anymore. It's much, the social aspect of the stock market is going to overwhelm and become more important than everything else. And how companies are going to deal with that going forward, and how the SEC is going to deal with that, how that's all going to come, you know, all these decisions are going to have to be made. But you're going to see it affect everything, I think. Short selling is a perfect example. Short selling is going to become more and more dangerous and more difficult, even though you can make very good arguments for it, right? There's a place for revealing when a company is doing poorly, or revealing that a company is fake or shouldn't exist. I mean, the Theranos trial is going on right now. You know, there are moments when someone needs to pull the plug on something and say, look at this. This is ridiculous. But shorting a company during a pandemic can be looked at very negatively, because there are ethical and moral quandaries to this that I think are not fully explored by people on Wall Street, but are definitely fully explored on social media.
One thing I do want to make sure that we address, because this was a huge point of contention at the time, was Robinhood shutting down trading and whether there was an establishment conspiracy.
Right.
And I'm curious for your view on it, because at the time, I remember thinking, this is crazy. Because it wasn't just Robinhood. It was like several other major
Discord,
brokerages.
And Discord.
Right. Well, Discord, like, that's a whole separate thing. Right, exactly.
Right. But then the Discord thing.
Very suspicious. Timing.
Right, so the Discord server goes down. Several brokerages shut down all at the same time. I believe even Wall Street Bets itself inaccessible for like 6 hours. And the people were trying to create new accounts. There was just a whole lot of confusion. And there was also a lot of suspicion that the Robinhood didn't actually have some sort of collateral call, that they had to put up cash, that this was at the behest of the people who are their actual customers, which are the hedge funds themselves. So can you unravel that bit for us?
Absolutely. This is really gets pretty interesting. So yeah. Robinhood doesn't make its money off the people buying and selling stocks on Robinhood, right? Because you don't pay any fees. You get that for free. So the people buying and selling stocks on Robinhood are actually the product, not the customer. The customer is essentially Wall Street. Robinhood moves all of those trades through market makers, and the main one being Citadel. Citadel handles 40% of all retail trades. It's basically at the center of the US economy. Citadel is kind of this, you know, scary to me, giant company run by this guy, Ken Griffin, who, if you read in my book, there's a lot of stories about him, and he's an intense personality who can be, you know, he's written about a lot all over the place and seems one of the most powerful people in the world in a lot of ways. And so Robinhood actually bundles up and sells its trades through Citadel. Now, Citadel, when this all went down, ended up pouring money into Melvin Capital, ended up bailing, and they don't like the word bailout, but Melvin Capital was in, you know, had lost $5-6 billion on all of these different stocks, was in an interesting position. And Citadel put in a couple billion dollars, made an investment in Melvin at an interesting time to make an investment in a company that just lost half its value. But anyways, that's what Citadel ended up doing. And the question becomes, why did Citadel invest in Melvin Capital? And if Citadel is where Robinhood makes all its money and Citadel is tied to Melvin Capital, when Robinhood froze trading on GameStop, did it do it at the behest of Citadel and Wall Street? And that's where everyone got very nervous and got very angry and said, what is Robinhood doing? Now, Robinhood says what actually happened was they have a collateral responsibility. When a certain amount of trades go through, they have this clearing issue. When I buy a stock, it doesn't happen instantly. It's not like I give you money for a stock and you give me my stock. There's something that happens over a two-day period called T+2 clearing, where I buy the stock, it goes through a market maker, they find someone to sell the stock, and then the stock is put into the account. During that two-day period, the brokers have to put up a certain amount of money to guarantee that buy and sell. That amount of money is based on the risk of that situation. The higher the risk of that situation, the more money the brokerage has to put up in clearing. Now, Normally, Robinhood, the week before this happened, had clearing collateral calls, meaning they had to put up like 150 million a day, 150 million a day. On that day, I think it was January 26th, was it 27th, mm-hmm. Somewhere in that week, their clearing collateral ask was $3.7 billion. So suddenly they had to come up with, and it was a 5 a.m. phone call. They get a 5 a.m. call from the Federal Clearing Commission saying, you need to put up $3.7 billion. They had in their coffer $700,000, somewhere in that order. So they needed to come up with a few billion dollars or they had to stop. So basically no one would be able to buy and sell anything if they didn't come up with $3 billion. Now, you can ask, why don't they have $3 billion if they're putting all of these trades through? Why can't they access $3 billion? I mean, there are plenty of banks that know that they're good for it. The trades are there, they're log trades. So it's not like the money's not gonna come back to them. And I think those are fair questions. Was their only choice to freeze trading? By freezing trading, they lowered their collateral cost by, I think it was $2.2 billion. So they were able to
figure their way out. And they raised $1 billion, right?
And then they raised $1 billion. So they were fine. And then they say this could never happen again because now we have enough money. But you wonder, was that really their only choice? Or did they panic? Or did they think, you know, or did someone make a phone call? Now, I personally think it's unlikely that Citadel would put their foot on them like that. I just don't think it's necessary. And just like in any, you know, they're the house. The house doesn't need to game the system to win. Citadel is always going to win. And so it's unlikely to me that there was only any real conspiracy there. But I do think there was a naivety and there was a misunderstanding of the moment. And there was a misunderstanding of how their customer base, the people who buy and sell through Robinhood would react to this. And how Robinhood handled it was very poorly. And then they just sent an email to everybody saying, oh, today you're not going to be able to buy GameStop. And it's like, what? I mean, that's
crazy. Right? I remember waking up and you type it in and it was just gray. And you're like, what? Like, this is nuts.
Right. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, but, you know, we didn't have a choice. And it's like, that doesn't seem fair. Right. And so the moment was handled poorly. I do think they got this collateral call. They did have to come up with a ton of money. But I do wonder why this was the only answer available to a company that is one of the darlings and unicorns in Silicon Valley. They certainly could have come up with a few billion dollars. I mean, Melvin Capital came up with $2 billion within a day, right? And they're just, you know, they're not the major brokerage in this whole thing. So I do think there were other options available to Robinhood, but I don't think there was a conspiracy to screw the retail trader. But I do think, again, Wall Street did benefit from this and they certainly took the opportunity. Not Melvin. Now, Melvin had already closed out of their shares, but there were plenty of other people who were short who ended up getting out of this because of this situation. And a lot of people, regular people, lost money. You know, maybe GameStop will get back to $500 one day. But, you know, what is it, 200 something or wherever it is now in the 200s? We'll see. But it's a lot of people did get hurt because they had bought on the way up thinking this was going to go all the way to 1,000. I don't think there was a conspiracy on the part of Wall Street, but I do think there was a lot of messy, orchestrating. The way they did it was very poor and the communication was awful. And I think that those things were part of the problem. Now, Robinhood says, look, what if we had said you can't buy or sell the stock? Would you be happier? And I think that would have been even worse in a way. If you were locked into your position on Robinhood and couldn't sell, that would be worse. So that's the reason they only stopped the buy side and let you still sell. But visually, it looks bad because it looks like we're letting people sell down the shares. We're not letting people buy it back up. So we're killing the run. And it did kill the run. It wasn't just Robinhood, a lot of companies. But now let's add in the Discord thing. Coincidentally, Discord, where all these people are gathering, shuts down saying that there was bad language. Now, there had always been bad language, right?
And Ben, could you explain the context of I think everyone gets Reddit, not everyone gets Discord.
So Discord is like, it's similar to Reddit, except for it's based around certain things that people link together. People go on and talk about this and communicate about this one thing. But it's much, I think, you know, I'm not that knowledgeable about Discord, but I think it's more of a free for all. I think there was a lot worse language and a lot worse. I mean, it gets pretty dark in some places, and as does Reddit as well. And I think that they decided to cut down on all of that at that moment. And that feels weird. It's like, why did they feel a need at that moment to shut down the ability to communicate around GameStop when they, you know, could have happened 10 days ago or 10 days forward? And then Wall Street Bets at the same moment goes dark or goes private for a short period of time. Now, part of that was because such a huge amount of interest, so many people joined on at the same time. It went from a few million to 9 million users in like a day. So you can kind of understand why they can't handle, they're no longer able to watch what's going on the site. It's just complete madness. But it did all seem to come to head at once. So in a lot of ways, it was a perfect storm of attention, drove all of these things to happen, and you can't really fault anybody. But at the same time, you start to wonder why it all seems to go to one side, why it all looks like it's the retail guy who's getting screwed and Wall Street doing well when things start to go bad. I don't know. I think conspiracy-minded people among us will definitely see a link there and wonder if somebody made a call to Discord and what are their financial backers and you know, that kind of thing. I think the reality is much more like there was a lot of angry people screaming, yelling, a lot of racist, negative things all over Discord, and Discord knew they just couldn't let it be a free-for-all, and so they just shut it down. That's probably what happened.
And here's a good way of tying it all together, especially if your point that you can't really blame any one individual or institution. What you can do is blame a system. You could blame the broader structure. And earlier you were talking about legality and you said, you know, for the first time ever, normal people can trade like their Wall Street banks. And the obvious question, and I'm not trying to advance position here, but it's the clear pushback, which is, should this be legal? Because ultimately Everything we're talking about is a social construction. There's no natural stock market. There's no natural Wall Street. There's regulations. There's an SEC. How do you just think about that fact there when it comes to whether or not people should be doing these things or shouldn't be doing these things? Because you could be a libertarian and say they should be able to, but even libertarians must acknowledge that even that is operating within a constructed system. So it's somewhat philosophically difficult.
Right. And this is great. Listen, this is something that where I have two minds about this. Part of me, you know, I go back to gambling and online poker and all this stuff, which I've written about a lot in the past. You know, part of me is like, this should be free for all to some extent. I mean, people should be free to do what they want with their money, you know. But as a rational adult now with kids, I look at this very differently. And I think what's happened with Robinhood and Wall Street and turning it into just a massive legal casino is scary and dangerous if people don't realize that's really what it is. Robinhood, the way the app works is too easy and too fun. And I think there's an element of casino, of the way a casino works in what they're doing, and it's purposeful. I mean, I think that they developed their app in a way to give you that casino feedback. You know, when you buy something, it makes you happy to use your money. And that becomes very, very dangerous because it's working on your mind in a lot of different ways that it's not just your rational mind. So on the one hand, I definitely think everyone should be able to use their money how they want to use their money as long as they're over the age of, let's say, 21. I don't think I have problems when it gets into high school. I know now I keep seeing ads for like trading accounts aimed at high school kids and things like that. And I just can't see that being a good thing. It's just not. Gambling is great fun if you're an adult, but it's also really dangerous. And in a lot of ways, gambling is a worse addiction than drugs because you go to rehab and you get off drugs and then you're done. But you lose your house, you don't get your house back, right? If you go down the gambling rabbit hole, you can't recover because you don't get that stuff back. And so the problem with the stock market becoming a giant casino and everyone having access to it is that we're not all going in there with the same education and we're not all going in there with the same knowledge of how the stock market works and all of the tricky things that are going on behind the scenes. Like a rational person getting into the GameStop thing would know, look, this is a short squeeze. It's very exciting, but a lot of crap can happen here. Stocks get stopped, right? People stop trading. The stock market gets stopped all the time. Robinhood's IPO stock got stopped multiple times during the day. But did everyone know that could happen? Did all the people I interviewed, you know, the 22-year-olds who were buying GameStop, know that they could stop the stock from trading? I don't think they all were even aware that that could happen, right? And so we're not all going into this with the same level of knowledge. There needs to be an educational aspect to it, I think, just like getting a driver's license, before you should throw your money into something like this, because it's dangerous. I think that Robinhood's idea of, you know, democratizing finance, giving everyone the tools of Wall Street, we should all be on a level playing field. I think it's well, you know, it's a good intentions, and the morality behind it is very good. And I do think we should all have the same, but we're not all the same, and we're not all going to have the same friends, and we're not going to all have the same, you know, ability to get out of the position. Like, that's another thing. A Wall Street bank can get into a position, lose a little money, and get out. But a college kid can lose all their money and be stuck in that position, right? They can't just walk away from it. And so on the one hand, it gives the Reddit base this power, this YOLO thinking. I was explaining YOLO thinking to people the other day. The idea is that if you have a ton of money, it actually is harder for you to take risks, because you don't think of it the same way. You have a lot more to lose. But if you only have $2,000 in your whole life, you don't care about earning 10%, right? Mm-hmm. You know that 10% makes no difference in your life. You need to make 10x, okay? So when you put your $2,000 into Wall Street, you're not happy doubling your money. Doubling your money, you don't just get out. Nobody gets out at double their money. They want to get 10 times their money. And so this is a very different mindset than what's going on in Wall Street. A Wall Street firm that doubled its money is incredibly happy and they are getting out. But a guy on the internet who puts $2,000 into GameStop wants to walk out with $20,000. And so they're willing to hold and go YOLO, right? We're going to hold it all the way to 1,000, right? Which is completely insane. But that's the way that they're thinking about it, because frankly, making $2,000 on your $2,000 isn't going to move the needle for you. Doesn't get you out of the problems you have. It's not going to change your life in any way. And that's another thing that Wall Street doesn't take into account. These 9 million users who each put $1,000 into GameStop aren't getting out when the stock goes up $10, right? They can have diamond hands, because for each one of them, it's meaningless. But for a Wall Street bank that puts $1 billion into something and it goes up 20%, we made our 20% and they can hop out.
Right.
And so it's a very different mindset. So in the end, there's no, I don't have a clear answer to your question, but the reality is there has to be some level of control. There has to be safety measures. There has to be a level of education. There ought to be, you know, a fair amount of watchdog regulation over just thousands and thousands of people being able to put all of their money into Wall Street. I think it's dangerous. I think in a weird way, the barriers of entry before did make it safer. For regular people. So I don't know.
And that's the most controversial take, but frankly, kind of one that I've come towards. And I know I'm supposed to be like, look, like, you know, if they can do it, why can't we do it? And it's like, but like you just said, whenever you lose it, when they lose, they don't really lose. Like Gabe Plotkin, as far as I know, is still a billionaire. Like, yeah. Oh, like,
and his company, you know, got refunded and, you know.
Right.
He's like, he's fine.
He raised a second fund. Like, he's good. And if you lost your life savings in GameStop, you're not good. Like, that's actually really bad.
Right.
Also, I do believe in freedom. And this is something that you said, which I want to take this kind of your thesis and push it forward, is the crypto space is where I see the natural evolution of all of this. And, you know, I will confess, like, I very much was on the side of the quote unquote retail trader. But where I really started to get concerned was around Dogecoin and NFTs. Because, and I read your book on crypto, Marshall, and I know plenty of very serious-minded folks who can articulate the best Bitcoin case that you'll ever imagine around money supply, about freedom, about democratizing finance, decentralizing, away from the establishment, the ability, you know, all of the cliches. But then Dogecoin comes along and actually number go up really is a very, you know, crude way of basically just saying what investment manager portfolios tell all their rich clients, which is that, you know, within this market, like, you can expect X amount return. But, and it did kind of take the veneer off of that. So I guess what I'm asking is, when we look to the frontier, and like right now, as you and I are talking, we see this NFT craze. Yeah. We see, we, you know, saw Dogecoin go up and crash. We saw SafeMoon or Mooncoin or like whatever it was. TikTok, you know, embraces one thing. And many of the people who kind of made their bones in GameStop with the credibility are just outright pushing this stuff with real financial interests themselves. That's where I think about the dubious legality of it, because there's no barrier to entry. If you have a bank account, you can go online, you can buy every single one of these things. Right. There's no regulation on it whatsoever. And I fear a lot of people are going to get fleeced.
I mean, listen, it's a really intriguing topic. And I think that when you look at Dogecoin, you're definitely seeing rationality has left the building, right? Totally, entirely, if people want it, the price goes up. If people don't want it, the price goes down. And then the danger of manipulation becomes sky high because there's nothing tied to it.
Right.
I think NFTs are a little different. And I'm actually getting involved in that. I'm learning as much as I can about it. I think a lot of artists and authors and people in this world are going to start gravitating into the NFT thing. And I look at the NFT thing. Again, I go back to the whole idea of the virtual world. You know, my kids would much rather spend their allowance on clothing for their Fortnite character who doesn't exist, right? Than to buy real things. They would much rather buy presents on video games. So to them and to younger people, the video world, the NFT world is as real as the real world. So if you don't have a problem with someone buying a Picasso for $100 million, I don't think there's a problem with buying a unique piece of art on the internet or a trading card or something, because there's no difference between a paper trading card and a video trading card.
Sure.
You can print a million paper ones too, right? So rarity, uniqueness, I think there is a place. NFTs do make sense to me, as does Bitcoin, because of the use of money. There should be a form of money that travels the way Bitcoin does, that doesn't have an authority in the middle. But there doesn't need to be a million of them. And there doesn't need to be one like Doge that where there's no limit to the supply. This is where it gets to me. The rarity and the uniqueness of something gives it value, right? Mm-hmm. If something is rare or unique, it can have value. And I don't have any problem with that, no matter what it is. I mean, gold is arbitrary, and we could pick any element and make it
antiques,
gold,
basically anything. Antique. Yeah,
right.
I understand the value of uniqueness and limited supply. But when you get something like Doge, it's simply manufactured value by people talking about it and by fame. I guess you could say its value is that Elon Musk likes it, right? You could say its uniqueness is that Elon Musk and Mark Cuban are talking about it. So you could make an argument that that's what makes it unique. But the minute they start not liking it, it is no longer unique and then goes down, right? And so I think that's where things ought to, I'm not someone who's normally pro enormous amounts of regulation, but certainly there's a place for regulation in the crypto market. And by the way, working with the Winklevoss twins in Bitcoin, they're people who totally believe that as well. They don't believe it's a free-for-all, and they want there to be some level of regulation and oversight, because people need to feel safe, and it needs to be a real thing rather than just this wild west of people running around, you know, buying and selling illegal things on illegal sites. So right. I agree with you. There's a craziness going on right now, but I also think it will work itself out. I think Doge is a perfect example of something that rides up and down based on how much people love it. And certainly you could buy it and make a little money and get out if you time it right, but it's pure gambling. It's pure speculation. There's nothing about it that is a financial instrument. There's nothing about it that makes any actual fundamental sense. If you're okay with that and you go into that with open eyes, there's a place for that. So I'm pro gambling. You know, I don't have a problem with people playing slot machines. I think that slots are fine, but you know, when you pull the thing, that it's a game, right? And then you have no control over it, and that's luck. And I think Doge is much like a slot machine. When you buy and when you sell, it's like pulling the little lever. And I think if people understood that, I would be okay with that. And then there could be something like Bitcoin, which I think should have some level of regulation, but is a form of money made for the internet. There ought to be a form of money made for the internet.
So we've got two last big questions here that get to the broader philosophical argument that's coming through with this book and with Bitcoin Billionaires. So to set it up, the first question would be, why did Occupy Wall Street fail? Because OWS was our sophomore year of college. So we actually really, unlike the dot-com bubble reference, I actively remember what was being said there. And rhetorically, at least, much of the energy moved in the same direction. Yet that version of populism didn't succeed. So what makes you think, why did that fail? Why did that traditional, because actually this is interesting because your point about virtual and the real world, why did the real world version of this fail? Right. To make an impact at all beyond inconveniencing some people of a park versus this.
Right. Great question. And I do tie a lot of this back to Occupy Wall Street because I think there's some themes that are very similar. It's this anger towards the fat cats making fortunes while everyone gets screwed. And there's, you know, and that's the reasoning behind it is true. And I think the difference is social media, is the idea that we all can be a part of this anger towards Wall Street, this Occupy Wall Street idea, without having to go sit in a tent in a park. and the visuals of that, I mean, it was scruffy, ridiculous people that we don't all agree with those people, but we agreed with their sentiment, you know? And nobody wanted to, like, I don't want to go block a park because I'm angry at JP Morgan, but I do want to make a fortune on GameStop because I'm angry at JP Morgan. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of differences in the ability to have regular people organized in a very large fashion and have a real shot at taking part in something like that without actually having to go out there and do it. I think we've seen real life protests that have made change, right? But they have to be enormous. They have to be, the whole, you know, world has to erupt over something to make any actual change. And it only makes little change. But online through social media, the whole world can erupt and react and do something together with very little effort and in a way that's so much more targeted. You know, Occupy Wall Street failed because of its the limitations of what it was. How many people were really gonna go sit in front of JP Morgan, right? A dozen, right? And how long could you do it for? A couple of days. You know, so it wasn't going to go anywhere, I think, really, really big. And then the other reality is we didn't really want to tear down Wall Street, because if you tore down Wall Street, we would all lose, right? Mm-hmm. We want a piece of it. We want to be able to do what they do. We want to get rid of these barriers. We want to make it more fair. I want to have a shot at being able to make money on Wall Street without all these dirty things going on behind the scenes that I have no control over. And that is what GameStop showed us we could do. For a brief moment, regular people sitting in on their couch made enough money to take down one of the largest firms on Wall Street, right? It actually happened and it actually was real. And in the end, the rug got pulled out, right? But for a time, you know, it actually worked and it was actually happening. So yeah, I think that the world has changed and gone virtual and gone big. And we are sort of becoming that interconnected world online that we're not really able to do in person. And even less so during a pandemic, to be honest. During a pandemic, it's less likely that you could get, you know, a movement against Wall Street going in the streets of New York that would make a difference. But you could, in a very big way, do it through the internet, because we were all sitting on Zoom and on Reddit and on everything like that. Right. So yeah, it was a moment. It was the moment in time, I think, that's changed.
Yeah, and my last cue here before I throw to Sagar is, if we're looking at this 2010s tech inevitability narrative space, one of the things that I think in retrospect we all agree was incorrect was the idea that these revolutions are inherently inevitable. It's hard to look at the Chinese tech market right now and think, oh, hey, like the internet and decentralization are these forces which are always going to knock down the pillars of the establishment, all these different parts. And this has only been something over the past 2 or 3 years here. But I'm just curious, how do you think of the inevitability aspect when we're talking about revolutions? Because I think the real thing we could really understand is that when we, and I'm saying we as in the royal we, were saying in 2011, 2012, wow, look at social media, look at this, this, and that. It has all these results. People who thought they were giving neutral analysis were actually putting their fingers on a scale in a way they did not realize they were.
Right. I mean, it's a really big, difficult question to ask. You know, is decentralization really coming? Is it inevitable? Are we really going to get to the point do we always work towards a more open, more free society is a question, or do we not? Is it more like ebb and flow? Is it more like, does it go like this, right? It opens and closes and open and closes. I think certain things are inevitable. I do think once you open the box, you know, the Pandora's box of the internet, there is going to be this push for all of us to be online more and more and more. I think there's going to be this push. You can't control things to the point where China tries to control things forever. So I do think there's an inevitability of some level of decentralization, freedom, things like that. But I do think, to your point, you know, you look at what Facebook wanted to be, which was this village that everyone gets to be a part of, and what it became, which was the silo, right? Facebook, Google, whatever, became silos rather than became open spread because they were in competition. The only way it really becomes open is if one of them takes over everything. And then everyone's a part of that one unit. And then in a weird, ironic way, that's what makes it decentralized. One person. So if China took over the world, we would end up in an open one world society. But you're right in that there are ebbs and flows and ebbs and flows in this more than an inevitable drive in one direction. But certain things, and I look at crypto, for instance, I just can't see a way that this doesn't succeed. Not just Bitcoin. I don't know about the price in Bitcoin and that like that. But the idea of a decentralized form of money isn't one country's money. I mean, we all read science fiction as a kid and everyone used credits in the future. They used one form of money. I just see that happening. And I feel like we move towards that. And social media too. We all live more and more online and we live more and more in this virtual world. So I do think we are moving into this virtual reality essentially more and more and more. But, you know, in between now and that point in the future, yeah, there's lots of ups and downs and ups and downs. And I think the pandemic threw a wrench in a lot of this. I think the pandemic moved a lot of us back towards isolationism, towards authoritarianism, towards China, you know, the way they run their economy and their country, because the reality was this virus came through and the things that worked need authority. they need a centralized structure to it. You need a centralized structure if you're going to have vaccines. You need a centralized structure if you're going to have quarantines. And so we're not, the libertarian dream doesn't work in a pandemic. Well, it does, but a lot of people die. And the libertarian doesn't work during mayhem and during periods of complete chaos, because people start to think for themselves and do things for themselves and it becomes a free-for-all. So yeah, you're right. I mean, I think it goes like this until you reach utopia, and maybe you never reach utopia. But right now, if I look at social media and I look at crypto, I think we're moving towards, you know, this inevitable decentralization. If I look at the world as a whole, it's a much harder, complicated question.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. Ben, it's been just such a pleasure talking to you. We really appreciate it. I'm really, you know, I think the book, it just really picks up on all those themes that you've already written about. Like I said, been a big fan for years. We're going to have a link down in the description notes for everybody to go and buy the book. Is there any place that you would like to direct people? Anything else?
No, I mean, listen, any of your local bookstore is always great. I love Amazon too. Talking about our future world. Amazon is definitely our future. And you can find me on Twitter or wherever, just Ben Mesrick. So awesome. Hope people enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.